Greetings, everyone. When I was flying the fanjet Falcon, as we would start to take off on the ground roll and I would put the throttles all the way forward, you were really impressed with the tremendous power of that airplane. It would just shove you back in the seat, and very, very quickly you're going 80 nautical miles an hour, 100, 121, V1 rotate, and the airplane is flying in the air. And you had a sense of tremendous power at your hands, right there in the controls. But when we flew the Falcon jet, it was a six-pack, well, actually, it could carry up to 11 people comfortably, but that would be putting somebody on the jump seat. It was a whole lot more comfortable with about six or seven people. And we could step climb to 37 or 39,000 feet, but because the airplane was so heavy with packs and bags and fuel, we actually started out about 5,000 feet per minute. Then we would taper off to about 2,000 feet a minute as the air got thinner and we got higher. And finally, we were only going about 500 feet a minute before we leveled off at 37,000 feet. But we had to stop at 33 and burn a while, burn fuel, which got rid of some weight. So essentially, it took us in our segment of planning 33 or 4 or 5 minutes to get to 35,000 feet. But now when I flew the G2, when I would start from a dead stop right there at the end of the runway and I would haul the nose into the air and start up, I could go all the way to 37, 39,000 feet in 14 minutes. A whole lot more powerful. But then the fuel load aboard the G2 weighed more than the Falcon and all the passengers and all the bags and all the fuel. But a Strike Eagle F-15 can rotate at the end of the runway and go straight up to 50,000 feet in 2 minutes. When I was at Apollo 7 and I saw men go to the moon, I looked over at that big gleaming rocket they had brilliantly lit. It was still early morning and not even any sunlight yet. And you could hear the hissing of the equipment over there and see the vapor coming up around it. 36 stories tall. When I was a boy and grew up in Oregon, the biggest building I ever saw, the tallest building on the West Coast, was the Smith Tower in Seattle, Washington, which was 36 stories tall. The tallest building in Eugene, Oregon was the Miner Building, only 9 stories tall. So when I looked at that rocket and realized that thing is as tall as the Smith Tower, 36 stories tall, 360 feet. And those great big engines produced 7 million pounds of thrust. And as they took off, and you could hear what they call a diamond effect, it actually, the explosions of that fuel were so great that it created a kind of a disturbance in the air that they called a diamond effect, which make it sound like a very powerful series of firecrackers going off, like a muttering or a staccato kind of a sound. It shook the ground, jingled a change in my pocket. I'm standing there with a microphone and hardly able to talk, describing men going to the moon. That was a very impressive display of power. But you know, my brother Richard David, who was killed in an automobile accident in 1958, knew about this test that was going to take place, and he went out to the Nevada desert, and he was out somewhere to the east of Las Vegas, and he saw the first test of the atomic bomb. It lit the entire landscape all around in the wee hours of the morning. And of course, that was just a little firecracker compared to the hydrogen bomb that came along a little later on. But he saw the night sky light up and heard the distant rumble some seconds later and was very deeply impressed by that. Well, now they developed in 1950, and the Russians got a copy of it later on, what was called the Chiloton bomb, a hydrogen bomb, which required an atomic bomb just as the fuse to set it off, like the cap or the primer to set it off. And a triloton bomb is equal, well, for example, a billion is 1,000,000,000. A million is 1,000,000, right? 1,000,000,000s. So you could make a millionaire out of 1,000 people having $1,000. And a billion, 1,000,000,000. And a trillion, 1,000,000,000,000. So a triloton bomb, the kind that they would have exploded over at the Bikini Atoll, which virtually destroyed the whole thing, sank a bunch of ships. It was a gigantic column. You know, I thought maybe we ought to send a picture of that to Saddam Hussein and paint the word Baghdad under it. But That is, you've seen that picture hundreds of times in your lifetime of that column of water that looked to be about 20 miles across and just little bitty dots on the ocean that were battleships and old obsolete cruisers and aircraft carriers they were using for tests. 1 trillion tons of TNT equivalent exploded and went off. Do you know that it would take every bulldozer, every earth scraper, every man with a shovel, laboring day and night, 7 days a week, from the time of Jesus Christ until today, to heap together a giant mountain of earth that would be equivalent to 1 trillion tons of TNT. Now, we are in awe, oftentimes, of man-made power. You ever been to a Bessemer oven? You ever been through a steel mill? I have. You ever seen some of the gigantic machinery that men use to make other machines and tools? It is awesome, and I think flight, and certainly space flight, and these great rockets that almost regularly we take at ho-hum for granted now, there'd be a little delay, maybe the shuttle is delayed because of a couple of days of rain. We don't even watch it, but if it were the first time, there would be tens of millions of people just chewing their fingernails, looking at your television, will this thing blow up on the launching pad? Will it make it? Will it get up into the air? You should have heard the thrills and the trills and the whistles and the screams and the applause when that rocket did launch and was starting to take men to the moon. And I'll tell you, the whole world was watching back during those days. It's hard to believe that that took place clear back in the 1960s, but it did. We had time to fly in the Falcon up to Orr, Minnesota and watch the landing on the moon by the time we got there because it took so long, and I saw those guys coming back. I was sitting outside by this time in Pasadena, California on a bright afternoon, and there was the most brilliant, what it looked like a star, but it was pulsing. It would be brilliant and then dim, and then brilliant and then dim. And what it was the returning capsule slowly turning. And as it turned, it was reflecting the sun's rays at a certain brilliance and then not quite so bright. And it was up there just right next to the daylight sliver of the moon that I could see. And here was this pulsating light coming closer and closer to the earth. And I was watching these men come back. Hebrews 11:6 says this, "But without faith, it is impossible to please him. For he that cometh to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of them that diligently seek him." Yesterday afternoon, I had a chance to talk to a couple of golfing buddies. One of them is a Roman Catholic, a Filipino, a retired doctor, was a heart surgeon, probably performed several thousand, I asked him one time, it was several thousand open heart surgeries. He's a very dear friend of mine, but he's a Roman Catholic. He doesn't practice his religion much. Another gentleman, I have no idea what his religion is, but I made a comment that stirred some kind of interest about evolution. And so they asked me about evolution and about creation, and I said, well, I don't want to give you a steak here instead of a baby bottle with a nipple on it, but I'm going to try to tell you a few things about it. And so they sat there for probably another 30 minutes and listened to me as I went over a lot of reasons why I believe and why I know that there is a God. The one gentleman wondered whether or not there was life on other planets. And I said, no, I don't believe so, because God's word does not indicate that whatsoever. I tried to tell him in a very short period of time, and I put it this way. Let me tell you the whole plan of God in a nutshell. God is reproducing after his own kind. I may as well have said, Dios, whatever, or said it in German, Gott, or whatever, and the rest of it in some of the strange language. They looked at me like, duh. Didn't have the faintest idea what I was talking about. And to try to explain that to a carnal mind, a good mind, a brilliant mind, a sincere mind, a talented, gifted mind, but trying to explain even that simple concept that Christ is the firstborn among many brethren, and drawn analogies about human reproduction and animal reproduction, which came first, the chrysalis, the pupa, or the moth, and let them think about that. I guess I tossed them so many New York cut steaks in about 10 minutes that they just couldn't begin to take it all in. But it was a pleasant conversation nevertheless. This that we are engaged in is a work of faith. Let me tell you how much faith I have in God and in this work. When we signed a note on this property, I signed a waiver. All of you people in Texas who have a home, whether you're paying on it or not, there's such a thing as a homestead law. And there is no power, no authority, no lawsuit, no nothing that can take your house or your property away from you. No matter what you do, declare bankruptcy, anything. In the state of Texas, that homestead law protects your home. But I had to sign a waiver and sign away the protection to our home, where we've lived for nearly 25 years, because I had faith that Almighty God is going to help us pay off this property. But my home is pinned irrevocably to the note on this property. What difference does it make? My life is dedicated to God and His work. So what is a collection of brick and drywall and shingles to the power of God? Now, what is faith, and do we have very much of it? You all know the faith chapter, and I won't wade through that. It would be very easy for me to concoct a sermon by simply looking at the exhaustive concordance, look up the word faith, and then go through about 20 or 30 scriptures and repeat and repeat and repeat. That's not what this is about. Hebrews 11 and verse 1, now faith is the substance of things hoped for. How can faith be substance? Substance is something which is like matter that has shape and weight, that is actually something which does exist. This pulpit has substance. Your body and the chair you sit upon has substance. The building has substance. If faith is the substance of things that you hope for, it's like you have it already. The evidence of things not seen. Do you ever want evidence that there is electricity flowing through the wires in your house? You can't see it. It'd be easier to get the evidence by just flipping on a switch and letting the circuitous travel of that power go from the transformer and the lines and the wires that come to your house right back to where they came from and light up a little element in a light bulb and give you some light, because it is a flowing of a current. But if you stick your finger in that socket and turn it on, you'll prove it. Your hair stand straight up and you'll shake a little bit. Some people have said they can take more of a charge of electricity than others, and I barely believe that, but you can't see electricity, you can only see what it does. There are thousands of things, really, in the physical sciences, especially in the area of communications, telecommunications, radio, television, and so on, that would prove to you that there are things which exist which you cannot see. You can't see air, you can't see magnetism, you can't see gravity, you cannot see, as I said, electricity. There are thousands of frequencies, LF, MF, TV, radio, all the way from the low band, clear on up to VHLF, and so on, in this room right now. If you had a handheld radio, you could hear aircraft approaching the tower out at Pounds Field. You could hear aircraft aloft checking with the controls in the Dallas or Fort Worth Center, wherever they're right now being handled as they fly. But you know that those frequencies are here because any of you with a cell phone could pick it out of your pocket and dial a number in Australia and talk to them, can't you? And you know that that is true, but you can't see it. So there are all these many things that we know that are there and are real that we can't see. And faith involves believing in something you can't see, believing in something you hope for, believing in something you might desperately need and want, such as healing or God getting you out of a horrible problem you've gotten yourself into, or even worse and tougher, certainly for you, not for God, but it's awful tough, you'd think, to pray that somebody else's attitude will change. A lot of people have problems with other people, and they pray that those other people's attitudes will change. So prayer is absolutely required in order for you and I to have faith. Jesus Christ said that. He said, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Look at Mark 4, 35 to 41. While you're turning there, we have enjoyed, I would imagine, about 6 days now here in East Texas of the most brilliant dry air, clarity of air. A couple of times this morning and yesterday morning, both times I went outside with my 10-power binoculars while it was still very dark outside and looked at some of the planets and the stars, and especially looked at that moon. And you can see the craters just pop right out, just so visible, even with 10 power magnification at that early time, because the clarity of the air. There's very little humidity in the air, and so it's almost like being up on top of a mountain in Colorado, very rare for East Texas, which is quite humid. And it's awesome. And as I stand there and look at it, I cannot help but say, how great thou art. How powerful is God. Now, we can talk about man-made machinery and jet aircraft and rockets going to the moon, but a trilliton hydrogen bomb is merely matter exploding. It was not an explosive which exploded. It was an explosive device which caused matter to explode. You and I are made of matter. You could be caused, and I could be caused, to explode by the process of nuclear fission or nuclear fusion. Nuclear. I wish George Bush could say that, but bless his heart. Neither could Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter said nuclear or something like that, and George Bush says nuclear, but it's nuclear. I sent him an email. I said, please, somebody in the White House, please tell him just to say N-E-W and then C-L-E-A-R, nuclear. Please tell the president, but they wouldn't do it. They never answered me. But I emailed the White House because I want him to be able to pronounce that correctly. Mark 4, 35 to 41. And the same day when even was come, now they were just over there where the Gadarenes were, and he had fed the 4,000 and 5,000, and they were on the other side of the Sea of Galilee. He said unto them, let us pass over unto the other side. And when they had sent away the multitude, they took him even as he was in the ship, and there were also with him other little ships, and I think that means boats, maybe a fishing boat about the size of a trawler or something. And there arose a great storm of wind, and the waves beat into the ship so that it was now full. And he was in the hinder part of the ship, asleep on a pillow. And they awake him and said unto him, Master, carest not thou that we perish? Don't you care? We're about to drown. Of course, he was placid and serene because he knew that there was no problem. And if there was, he could take care of it. And so they were very disturbed. And he arose and rebuked the wind and said unto the sea, peace, be still. I imagine he put his hands out. And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. I imagine it took a few minutes, but, you know, I've been out on a lake and when it was very turbulent and the wind would die, and little by little it would calm down. So that probably is what took place. And he said unto them, why are you so fearful? How is it that you have no faith? They had just come from a tremendous miracle that took power of God beyond your ability to comprehend. How do you dip into a basket while you're watching and you see a fish materialize before your eyes? You're breaking bits and pieces of bread, and as you break the bread and pass it out, there's more bread where that came from. And he says, how is it that you have no faith? And that's quite a lesson, because even Jesus Christ was mystified that at least the evidence of the great miracle that he just performed didn't bolster it up enough to realize that just wake him up and ask him and he'll take care of it. But they were completely puzzled. They didn't understand that he had that kind of power. They feared exceedingly and said one to another, what manner of man is this that even the wind and the sea obey him? Well, Almighty God made the wind and the sea. All of that is physical. And Jesus Christ has power over the wind and the sea. Look at Matthew 17, 14 to 18. When they were come to the multitude, there came to him a certain man kneeling down to him and saying, Lord, have mercy on my son, for he is a lunatic and sore vexed, for oftentimes he falls into the fire and oft into the water. So the demon that had possession of this boy was trying to destroy him and wanted the boy to be burnt to death or somehow to drown, to kill him. And I brought him to your disciples, and they could not cure him. Then Jesus answered and said, O faithless and perverse generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I suffer you, or endure you, or put up with you? Bring him hither to me. And Jesus rebuked the demon, should say demon, not devil, and he departed out of him, and the child was cured from that very hour. An awful lot of lunacy is demon possession, and of course the American Psychiatric Association does not recognize that. Neither does the AMA, American Medical Association, or anybody else for that matter. Very few people do, although people delight in movies like The Exorcist or all kinds of movies about demoniacs, and in entertainment they like to get into that, the occult, and at Halloween time. But the medical fraternity does not even crank that into their consciousness as a possible diagnosis of mental illness. They'll come up with something else like dementia praecox or whatever, and it will not be demon possession, but oftentimes it is. Now going on in verse 19 to 21, then came the disciples to Jesus apart and said, "Why could not we cast him out?" And Jesus said unto them, "Because of your unbelief." They didn't really believe that they could. They said, "We command you to come out." But they weren't sure of the result. They didn't have an absolute positive assurance that there was power flowing, the power of the Son, the power of the universe, through them to the victim who was being possessed by a demon. They didn't have that power. Time out. I want to talk about something as an aside for a minute. There are about 250 organizations, the last I heard, that spun off from Herbert W. Armstrong and the Worldwide Church of God. All kinds of them. And many of them have a special little hook that they hope they can use on you, which will make them more holy, holier, that will make them closer to God, which will make them more accurate with the Scriptures. Many take exception with the calendar. Many take exception with the order of events at the time of the Passover and the days of unleavened bread, the Lord's Supper. They take issue with everything from a place of safety to who knows what. And many of them have all kinds of different, what appears to be almost scholarly arguments about the postponements or about the sixth hour, whatever. What is universally true of these organizations that you know about? What do they all have in common? That is one thing that we have in common with them. They have in common the utter inability to heal anybody. Not a one of them has the gift of healing. I sometimes wonder what all this "let's get holier than the other group" is about. Because obviously they don't get holy enough to do anybody any good in a hospital bed. They don't have the power to cause the deaf to hear, or I'd take them my two sons. They don't have the power for the blind to see, or we take care of some people that I meet at the Feast of Tabernacles. One gentleman many, many years go up to, and he will know me by my voice. And I'll grab his hand. He's a black man. He's a wonderful man, but he's totally blind. How I would love to put my fingers out on his eyes and tell him to be healed. I'm not sure that anything would happen except my embarrassment if I did so. So I can acknowledge right along with all the rest of them and all of you, I do not have a kind of a gift of healing to where I could go into a hospital and start emptying beds all up and down the corridor. I don't have that power. I have seen a miracle or two or three. I've seen some fantastic miracles in my lifetime. I won't go into all of them. One involved a healing of my wife of a rupture. Another involved healings of members of the family or other people I heard about, like James Friddle's mother years ago, who had had x-ray treatments that had just about cooked her insides, and she was anointed by my father and healed miraculously. But I've also seen evangelists' wives and my own mother die. I saw that my brother Richard David died, even though my father prayed for him many times. I saw my mother die, and I held her hand as I watched the light go out of her eyes when my father and every one of us evangelists would go to his study, virtually on a, not a daily basis, but certainly every week or so, and we would all get on our knees, 9 or 10 or 12 of us, and we would all pray audibly right around the table. And then when we were all prayed up, confessing our own inadequacies, many times even with tears, we would go into my mother's bedroom and my father would lay hands on her and anoint her. And my mother died. You have to handle that some way or another. Well, how do you handle that? You say, it's got to be a lack of faith. It's got to be our fault. You know it's not God's fault. And you know that it's our lack of faith that you can't just go like Peter at the gate called Beautiful and say, "Rise and walk." And you know that it says in James 5:14, if any is sick, let him call the elders of the church and let them anoint the sick with oil, and the prayer of faith shall save the sick. And you also know that the Apostle Paul, when he shook off the serpent on the Isle of Malta from the twigs that he picked up for a fire, and it did him no harm, even as it said, as Jesus said, they shall pick up poisonous serpents or drink harmful or poisonous things, and it shall not hurt them.
And you know that early on in his ministry, great miracles occurred. In the first few chapters of the book of Acts, there are all kinds of great healings that took place. Yet later on, Paul said a messenger of Satan was given unto him. And in the book of Galatians, he says, you see how with such large letters I've written, and I say unto you that you would have given me your own eyes. So we know it was his eyes that were somehow defective, maybe cataracts, maybe something else, a disease of the eye that affected his seeing, his sight. And he wasn't healed. And he wrote to Timothy, drink no longer water. Of course, in the Middle East, water was questionable, as it is in Mexico today. But a little wine for your stomach's sake and your oft infirmities, didn't he? Trophimus have I left at Miletum sick, he said. So you see that in the early days of the beginning burst of faith in the Church of God, that there were great miracles that took place. And many people were healed, and a young man that fell out of a balcony when Paul was preaching and broke his neck was taken up without a pulse or a breath, and actually was healed and raised up right there. Peter and Dorcas and so on. Examples of the raising of the dead. But it gradually waned. It gradually grew less and less until Paul wrote the things that I just stated. So that miraculous healings were not taking place to anywhere near the same degree as the canon of the New Testament was closing. And at the end of Paul's life, in maybe the mid-60s AD, 30-some years after the time of Christ, as they had been in the first months and years. It makes me wonder if there will be a mirror image of that. I do know this, that at the time of the preaching of the two witnesses, their ministry is not a healing ministry. It is a ministry of witness and warning, and a ministry in which they can actually call plagues down upon those nations that are going to support the beast power. And it says that they have power way beyond that of Elijah and Elisha, because they can smite whole areas of the earth with their word, like Moses and Aaron did in Egypt at the time of the Exodus. Not just one locale, but the whole world, anywhere around the world, Revelation 11. But what about this side of the two witnesses? Will the Church of God be given spiritual gifts that will be so powerful that no one can gainsay what they see happening? Now today, the television cameras are there. The evangelist is perspiring freely. He's probably wearing a white suit. He's got his hair parted here. If he let it down, it would hang all the way to his knee. And he's got it over on the other side and sprayed with some kind of glue that keeps it in place. Takes off his jacket and goes whop with it, and about five people fall over like ten pins. And the AMA doesn't show up. The medical fraternity isn't there. No doctors examine the people before they come in, and then as they go out, that's never allowed. There are the burly guys there that wouldn't allow that. There are a lot of guys there that will throw you out if you act up and act like you don't really believe what you see going on. It's all for show. But if we did it, the AMA would be there. All the major media would be there, ABC, CBS, NBC, Fox, and CNN. They would all be there with their cameras, and not a one of them would believe it, and they would doubt it. So what I'm telling you is that miraculous healing and great miracles are a tool of evangelism, and they are for the unbeliever. They are not necessarily day in, day out, wonderful blessings that come from God just on a daily basis, where no child ever gets a cold or a runny nose. No one ever has an automobile accident. Nobody ever gets food poisoning. Nobody ever has any kind of debility or disease. They afflict us all the time, don't they? Almost annually. If there's some kind of a flu and it's going through the area where I live, you can almost guarantee I'm going to get it. I'm going to try not to, but it seems that every now and then I do. I had to tackle an upper respiratory problem just before the feast, and it caused me a lot of trouble. And I'm very thankful to God that I'm over it now. My voice is back to full strength. But it wasn't healed by divine fiat immediately. So sometimes I wonder if there is a downside to the desire for great miraculous power. Because that is one way by which, without us spending $40 or $50 or $100 million on television, just a few examples of a totally blind person seeing, a deaf person hearing, a lame person walking, and we would have all the publicity we could ever handle. Now, you know that's true, because that could not be kept secret very long. That would get out, and here would come the cameras, and it would be very newsworthy. Well, he went on to say, Jesus said unto them when they asked, why couldn't we cast him out? And Jesus said, because of your unbelief. For verily I say unto you, if you have faith as a grain of mustard seed, you shall say unto this mountain, remove hence to yonder place, and it shall remove, and nothing shall be impossible unto you. Now that would be destructive if people lived on the mountain. And so it is metaphor, it's an example. And Christ is using it not to say that if you have enough faith, you can say to Mount Wilson out there above Los Angeles, with all kind of people up there hiking, camping, with about humpteen television antenna and a whole bunch of facilities, that they all die because it goes out into the sea, which would cause a giant tsunami, which would drown half of Los Angeles. I had a man actually tell me, right there looking out the window of the library at Mount Wilson, you know, Garner, Ted, the feeling came over me one time when we were reading that, that I just felt like if I'd have said to Mount Wilson, be thou removed into the sea, it would have gone. I said to him, I'll tell you what, Rudy, excuse me, I shouldn't have said a name. I'll tell you what, next time that feeling comes over, you just go ahead and move that little bitty mountain over there. Because that was nothing but a lot of spiritual braggadocio and wanting to come to my attention and wanting to sound really spiritual and faithful, that he just knew that that would happen. Well, nonsense. Verily I say unto you, if you have faith as a grain of mustard seed. He used that analogy because the mustard seed is one of the tiniest of all seeds, even smaller than a radish seed. Smaller than a little, you know what lettuce seed looks like a little kind of a piece of a fingernail clipping. Tiny little seed. But it grows into a very large plant where shrub size or small tree size where birds can roost in it. Howbeit, he said, verse 21, this was a demoniac, goeth not out but by prayer and fasting. Prayer and fasting. There were times back in the early days in the college when my dad would call upon the student body to fast. And I remember there was one time in particular, I wish I had the statistics because we used to remember them better than I do now. My dad had not sent out a letter. There was no reason for what happened, except that we were in dire straits and in desperate need of money and for all the world broke and great big bills having come in. I'm just saying that my father must have written that in his autobiography, because the students fasted and prayed and we had an overwhelming influx of money come in and letters and mail come in that we didn't remotely expect. And the only way we could ever understand that was because of the desire of the students to fast and to pray. And I remember, too, that there were other occasions, not just for the sake of the work, but I know a lot of people fasted and prayed for my mom. And I remember having to preach a sermon only a few days. I've still got the sermon notes. Mom died at thus and such a time in the wee hours the other day. It's right there in my home. Come across that every now and then when I look through my old sermon notes. And why did God let her die? That had to be my subject of the day. I had to tackle that in my own heart and mind and from the standpoint of the Scriptures. Why does God let anybody die? People have told me in the last year, why did God let Richard David die when he was out doing the Lord's work? He was out doing a baptizing tour. And I have his Bible that actually has water damage that was in the ditch where his body ended up. I say his body, he wasn't dead for another week and died in very great agony over a period of time. But people don't understand that. How can God let one of God's ministers die? Well, it's like asking, why did God let Stephen die? Why did God let Paul die? Why was James, the brother of John, allowed to be beheaded? Why were they able to stone Stephen to death? We don't know the answer to every question like that, except Stephen was allowed to go through what he did because he became one of the most famous martyrs of all time, and there have been literally hundreds of thousands of people in all kinds of races and nations who have named their young children after Stephen. Esteban, Stefano, Stefan, Stephen, and so on. Matter of fact, I have a nephew named Stephen, and it's a very wonderful name. Look at Luke 9:37-42. This is when they're going to go to the other side of Gadarene, or from the Sea of Galilee. This is just after the Transfiguration. They had just seen the Transfiguration, but remember, he would not take Judas Iscariot, or Simon the Canaanite, or Thaddeus, or Bartholomew, or James the Less, but he only took James, Peter, and John. They were the only three disciples that were allowed to go with him to the mountain and to see the transfiguration. And he told them when they came down, "See that you tell no man. See that you tell the vision to no man," proving it was a vision, not an actual materializing of Elijah and Moses. It came to pass that on the next day, when they were come down from the hill, much people met him. And behold, a man of the company cried out, saying, "Master, I beseech thee, look upon my son, for he is mine only child. And lo, a spirit taketh him, and he suddenly cried out, and it teareth him, and he foameth again, and bruising him heartily departed from him. And I besought thy disciples to cast him out, but they could not." And Jesus answered, said, "O faithless and perverse generation, how long shall I be with you and suffer you?" This is the other account. This is Luke's account of the same thing we read. Bring your son hither. And as he was yet a coming, the devil, the demon, threw him down and tear him, so he was having all kinds of spasms. And Jesus rebuked the unclean spirit and healed the child and delivered him to his father. We already read when they were amazed and said, "Why couldn't we cast him out?" that he said, "This kind cometh not out but by prayer and fasting." There was the attempt by some people to cast out a demon and said, "We adjure you by Jesus whom Paul preacheth." And the demon said, "And who are you?" And there were about seven strong young men, and the demon was so powerful in that man that he ripped all the clothes off of them, beat the way out of all of them, and they fled away naked. So they tried to seize power they didn't have. And they went up against a power they didn't know anything about. Because demons have great power, especially inside a very powerful and strong man. Now, just after the Lord's Supper, Luke 22, 20 and 34, verses 20 through 34, breaking into the middle of that thought, "Likewise, also the cup after supper, saying, This cup is the New Testament in my blood, which is shed for you. But behold, the hand of him that betrays me is with me on the table. And truly the Son of Man goeth as it was determined, but woe unto that man by whom he is betrayed." And they began to inquire among themselves, and obviously there's a lot of clearing of oneself. "Well, boy, certainly I would never do it. Who do you think it is?" "Well, I don't know." It was kind of an argument got going. "Which of them it was that should do this thing?" So all of a sudden, suspicion. They're all looking at one another. "Who is it? Who is it? Who is it?" And there was also a strife among them. So the one conversation gradually devolved into another conversation. Who is the most loyal? Since they're talking about who is the traitor, it gradually devolved into, "Well, since I'm not the traitor, I'm more loyal than you are." And there was an argument. Who is the most loyal? And consequently, which one of them should be rewarded with the greatest job in this new government that Christ was about to set up? Which of them should be accounted the greatest? And he said unto them, "The kings of the Gentiles exercise lordship over them, and they that exercise authority upon them are called benefactors." That's the way our federal government acts toward us. They act like they are our benefactors. They take away from us all the money we earn from January 1st to the latter part of June. And then they dole back a little bit of it, and we're supposed to feel real glad. "Hey, they gave us back $600. I only gave them $54,000. And we say, "What a benefactor, what a wonderful government we got here to give me all that money." And we bow and scrape before guys like Daschle. Well, I better not get into that. Better not get into politics here. "But you shall not be so, but he that is greatest among you, let him be as the younger, and he that is chief as he that doth serve. For which is greater, he that sits at meat, and being served, he's the owner of the household and has servants there, or he that serves? Is not he that sitteth at meat? But I am among you as one that serves." He just got through washing all of their feet, for pity's sake. And he was humble. He wasn't prideful. He wasn't sitting there at the head of the table. I don't care what Da Vinci painted. There's not necessarily any proof that the table was one-sided and all facing a wall or posing for a painting, like in the famous Last Supper scene, leaning on one another's breast, about 16 conversations going on, John there with a beatific look on his face. That's not true. They were sitting around probably several tables. They were very low. They were half reclining on cushions, and they were eating with their fingers largely. So when Christ gave Judas the sop, he reached in and got a piece of pita bread, probably unleavened, and folded it just like you would a piece of, frijoles. No, not the frijoles, that's the beans at the Mexican restaurant. And it said, to whom I give the sop? Well, there were slivers of the meat that was roast lamb and the juices. So he just scooped up some of the meat and rolled it in what was called a sop, like you take a piece of bread and sop up some gravy, and handed it to Judas. They were reclining. It said that John had leaned on Christ's bosom. He'd put his head right here on his shoulder. And Jesus told him some things privately that John wrote about. Whether is greater, he that sits at meat or he that serveth? Is not he that sitteth at meat, but I'm among you as he that serveth. You are they which have continued with me in my temptations, and I appoint unto you a kingdom as my Father has appointed unto me, that you may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom, and sit on thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. When carnal-minded Protestant people and Catholic people read that scripture, if they ever do, their brain goes tilt. They don't know what in the world they're dealing with. There they are, sitting up in heaven, ruling over the tribes of Israel. It's kind of like, look at my badge, look at my flag, look at my kudo, look at my epaulette, look at my hat. I'm a ruler. But it doesn't come across to them as being literal. In the millennium, on this earth, that each one of the disciples will be a king with absolute autocratic power coming from God and backed up by David, who is the king over all of them, and Jesus Christ, and will be administering justice and mercy to all of the 12 tribes of Israel. That it is real and it's really going to happen. That doesn't occur to most people that read that. And the Lord said, Simon, Simon, behold, Satan has desired to have you that he may sift you as wheat. Interesting. Peter, therefore, was one of the loudest. Peter, therefore, was one of those who most vociferously was saying, I certainly would never betray him. I am more loyal than you are, Thad. I'm more loyal than you are over there, James. They call you the little. Whoever, you know, do you think you are? I am more loyal than any of you. And so Jesus said, Simon, Satan has desired you that he might sift you as wheat. And I have prayed for you that your faith fail not. And when you are converted, and he wasn't yet, strengthen your brethren. And he said, Lord, I'm ready to go with you both to prison and to death. Very boastful. And he said, I tell you, Peter, the cock shall not crow this day before you shall deny thrice that you know me. You see what went on there? None of them really had the empathy to understand what Christ was going through. They didn't understand his agony and his trauma and what he was looking at, what was going on in his mind and heart. They were thinking about themselves. And the idea that somebody was going to betray him, all that did was just generate a great big cacophony of arguments and boasting about which one was the most loyal, which led gradually into an argument about who was going to get the chief seat. And then sure enough, Peter had the greatest lesson of his life because he faded in the dark and went down there and tried to warm his hands at the fire where they were beating on Jesus and denied that he knew him. Let's go to Luke, the 18th chapter, because this is one lesson. By the way, the word faith only appears about three times in the entirety of the Old Testament. But there must be several hundred that I looked up this morning. I didn't count them all. Just a couple or three huge columns of the word faith in the New Testament. The word faithful or faithfulness is in, and the just shall live by his faith is in the Old Testament, of course. But it's interesting that there is so much in the Gospels about faith. He spoke a parable unto them to this end, that men ought always to pray and not to faint. Well, fainting means quitting, meaning letting up on your prayer. Now, I know from experience that there are peaks and valleys in every Christian's life. And I know that there are distractions. I know that there are times when you don't pray like you should. And when you pray in little quick snatches. And you don't really, as they used to say, pray through, meaning know that you're really in communication with God after being on your knees for maybe 45 minutes or an hour 15 minutes, to where your knees are hurting and your back is hurting and you're just really having a struggle in prayer. Satan the devil will do everything he can, and his demons will do everything they can to distract you from prayer. They will try to get you to pray wrongfully. They'll try to get anything to interrupt you while you're in prayer. They'll try to get some thought into your mind about something you've got to do, a phone call you've got to make, some other priority that is bigger a priority than prayer. And so sometimes in the valleys of your spiritual experience, when you're having problems, personal, emotional, spiritual, or otherwise, family, whatever, you don't pray when you should. You know what is ridiculous? At the very time when you need prayer more than any other time in your life is the time when you don't want to pray. So somehow you have got to force yourself to pray. And I don't know if that means, you know, locking yourself in your bedroom and setting the alarm for 1 hour and just saying, I'm not getting up off my knees till that alarm rings or what. But it is axiomatic that the more you need God because of troubles in your life, the more the human proclivity is to put it off and not to go to God. And then when you're feeling real good and you feel like praying, maybe that's when things are going a whole lot better for you and you don't feel that you really need to, so you go ahead and give God a little bit of your time. I'll never forget a wonderful sermon John Hill preached at Squaw Valley. He walked up there with a lot of vim and vigor, and he came up real rapidly, and he got up there before the microphone, and he went, and he kept that up for about 2 full minutes. I went for 15 seconds. And people were going crazy. What in the world? He says, that's what it sounds like in heaven when you don't talk to God, you know. He looks at the book of Revelation, there was silence in heaven for a half hour, no women there, you know, that kind of thing. And he really got them going. I'll never forget the way he started that sermon. It was very effective and, of course, very funny as well. But it really showed how people will not pray. Luke 18:1-8, he spake a parable to this, that men ought always to pray and not to faint, meaning never to quit, never to get rid of prayer as a part of your life, never to cease for very long. If you skipped a couple of days, get busy and make up for the time. I don't care if that means you're 18 or 85. All through your life, you continue. Now, do you continue to pray for the same thing? Or do you just give up praying for that because you haven't had an answer in 40 years and you don't think you're ever going to get one? Saying, there was a city and a judge which feared not God, neither regarded man. And there was a widow in that city, and she came unto him, saying, avenge me of mine adversary. And he would not for a while, but afterward he said within himself, though I fear not God, nor regard man, yet because this widow troubles me, I will avenge her, lest by her continual coming she weary me. And the Lord said, hear what the unjust judge saith. Now, obviously, this is metaphor. It's not saying that God is unjust. It's not saying that God gives in to nagging. He is giving you an example of a very bad man in order to illustrate the point that, like the widow, you never cease and desist. You keep at it, keep at it, keep at it, and you never give up. Sir Winston Churchill said, and he emphasized it during World War II, you never, never, never give up. And people got what he meant. And there was no greater example in the history of the world of imperturbability and absolute stubbornness and iron will than Churchill leading the British people in 1939 and 40 and 41. That truly was the finest hour of the British people. And shall not God avenge his own elect? See, this is in opposition to. If an evil judge will give in to nagging, why would not a merciful God avenge his own elect, which cry day and night unto him, though he bear long with them? So the example is, you never give up. I could be tempted to give up on prayer because so many things have never been answered. My brother died. My mother died. Father-in-law died. Sister-in-law died, brother-in-law, two of them died. Prayed for all of them. Go and pray for beloved members of the church. Dear Mr. Freeman went over to the hospital in Longview and prayed for him. And I understand he's clear back at his house again now and still has not yet had that operation. So we still need to pray for Mr. Freeman. And so many people that just have a protracted, terrible struggle with bad health and debility and disease, and it seems like there's no miracle. They don't just jump out of the wheelchair and get strong and young again, and it takes so long. Have you ever thought that maybe it is good for you to continue to pray, and that there is a two-way street here? Not just the individual who has not yet received the answer that you desire, but the fact that you, by building into your character perseverance, my father used to call it stick-to-itiveness, perseverance and never quitting, are building into your character something that is invaluable for the kingdom of God. So Christ said, never quit. And he says, I tell you that he will avenge them speedily. Nevertheless, when the Son of Man cometh, shall he find faith on the earth? He doesn't answer that question. He leaves it hanging. Let's ask ourselves, when Christ comes, will he find faith on earth? Will he find a faithful church, a faithful people who really do trust God in faith? Now, healing is only one aspect. There are so many other things that have to do with God's work and God's word and living the kind of a life that God wants us to allow Jesus Christ to be the pattern after which we are formed and shaped as a new creature in Christ, that Christ is the firstborn among many brethren, and that we're to be Christ-like in the way we treat other people. And many of us still have a long way to go in that regard. There are an awful lot of people who go through the motions and who let this world come crowding in via television, the movies, the printed page, the age of total trash and literature. I was stuck in a little shop to get my hair cut here this last week. There was nothing there to pick up and look at while this other lady was getting her curls taken out. The lady was getting her curls taken out. And I was, there was only about four or five magazines. One of them was Cosmopolitan. I picked it up, pornographic cover. But you ought to see the inside of the thing. And it was something like 25 ways to get him feeling sexy or whatever. It was sex, it was makeup, it was hair, it was barely clad women. All the Cosmopolitan magazine is pornography anymore. And I hadn't picked up one of those dumb things or looked at it forever, but I paid through that thing, and one startled expression on my face after another, I suppose. But you know, you have got to fend off this world from your children and from yourself, because there are people who will gradually give in to it. I remember a case, well, I won't go into that, it's kind of ugly, so let me not go into things that people, you know, different mistakes that people make, and we're all human, we all need God's mercy and God's forgiveness, and we all do slip and slide, as they say in the Protestant world, backslide sometimes, but God will pick us up. And if we've come to understand in God's word, the only unpardonable sin is the sin for which you never ask pardon. It is not a category of sin that you might have committed, or you might have done this particular kind of thing too many times instead of just two or three times. And therefore, God's had it with you and he won't forgive you anymore. No, 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 that's not right. Even as Peter said, how oft shall I forgive if my brother offend me, unto 70 times 7. And God is even more merciful than that. My father once told me many years ago, and I guess I'd gotten on my high horse and I was being very impatient with someone or something, and he said, Ted, you're going to find out someday that God is even more merciful than you think he is. And I've never forgotten that. That was a good lesson. This is a work of faith that we are doing. Now, I want to tell you a little bit about what we're planning and what the future might hold for this work. Just share some thoughts with you and see if you don't take this as something that you ought to be praying about. I know this, that every single day when my son David goes to the post office over at Flint, we have faith that that box is going to be fairly full of letters. And every single week, about twice a week, he will Xerox or fax me a report on income. Just before the Feast of Tabernacles, we had dipped down so low that we were getting very close to wondering if we were going to have the money to pay WGN. But the money came in. And though we spent $16,000 for the Feast of Tabernacles in Myrtle Beach, the offerings were about $16,000. And we spent exactly the same amount down in Panama City Beach, and the offerings were somewhat larger than that. And we didn't spend very much here in Tyler, and so the offerings in Tyler were probably proportionate to the amount we had to spend, larger than anywhere. But as a result of the little bump upward in income that we received at the time of the Feast of Tabernacles because of the holy day offerings from Trumpets, Atonement, First and the Last Great Day, the income came right on back, and the next couple of months, the last number of weeks, or whatever it's been now since the Feast of Tabernacles, we're right back where we were at a very nice level where we're able to pay WGN, all the other television stations, all the big bills that come in. We're able to pay everything on time. We never yet have had a late bill where someone has tried to penalize us for paying late, and that shows you it's a work of faith. It's, as I said, it's like a roller coaster. And you know, you get to the very top, that first fall down there. I haven't been on a roller coaster since I was a very young man and don't intend to ever get on one again. I love to fly, but I don't like roller coasters. But it is a thrill. You can say that. Now they got them where you're hanging out in the open air upside down. You do a complete loop and you're looking down and there's the earth down there and you're hoping your seatbelt holds. And people get a kick out of that. They like to be scared. They like to be jolted and tossed around. I don't. But I get enough of the roller coaster ride just watching the income. And it's kind of, and then, oh, boy. And sometimes you go, and then a week or so later, it's, here we go. We're fine. We're just fine. Well, the people in Australia have been begging me to come down there for years. So finally, it looks like perhaps in the month of February in 2003, we'll be able to go down there and have a three-meeting trip in one 10-day span, where two Sabbaths and on a Wednesday, and Mr. Murray Allatt and the others down there are trying to set that up. We're still working on the exact dates and everything. But I would like people to pray about that. I would like them to pray for our safety. I'd like them to pray that that big Qantas 747 or American Airlines or whatever stays in the sky. And no rag-headed idiot gets aboard with a pair of scissors in his hand, or whatever. We'd like to pray that somebody that, you know, hates Australia just like they hate us, witness the bombing in Bali, does not throw a bomb or walk into our meeting with a bomb strapped around his waist. Because I know that I'm hated by a lot of Muslims. I know because of our website, because of what I've written, what I've preached about, what I've said on television, that there are any number of Muslims that are fanatics who would just love to do me in, and of course all of you and all of us along with me, but it's not just me, and I'm not talking about being anybody special, because any so-called Christian, including especially guys like Jerry Falwell, whom they hate with a purple passion, these people would love to get at if they could. But you all know the risks when you travel, especially overseas, and so I would just like to throw that out. Also, we're looking at searching for special times on some of the cable networks and going ahead and maybe paying, if we need to, up to $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, or even $50,000, if we have to, for a prime time spot and do the kind of a program that we feel, if we line up the, you know, dozen, they have services that do that where you can have 800 numbers and they will call in, and instead of about five people or three people we got answering the phones, they've got a couple hundred people that will answer the phones, and we would look to do something like, wouldn't it be wonderful if we could double our mailing list in one night? Wouldn't that be something to shoot for? We've got a little more than 50,000 on the mailing list. There are millions of Americans out there that still don't know where I am. And used to listen to me faithfully all the time. I don't know if a single day goes by. I could ask Cecil and Cecilia, but what at least one person might say, well, I've been looking for him forever, didn't know where he was, and glad to find the program. Doesn't happen that often, but I know it does happen with some regularity. So if we could pray enough that God would open the door, he would give us both the wherewithal, income, and it would open the door. We bought a pig in a poke with TNN. We didn't know it. That's an old colloquial Southern expression. A Yorkshire and a gunny sack. But it meant that we bought something that was falsely misrepresented to us, that we thought we were buying the entire TNN network, and all they did was give us the spot, kind of a selection of the local cable stations who decided, based upon their local content, whether they wanted to pull in TNN off the satellite at that particular time or not. So we just got here and there a few spotty calls, New England and maybe Merced, California, but nowhere near what we had hoped that we would. And that, I can't tell you the exact statistics, I can go back and get them, but I think that hit us for about $40,000. And in a span of time where we got just a handful of calls, and that is a terrible waste. I mean, if we'd have seen that coming, there's no way we would have ever taken that. So I'd ask you to pray that God would open the proper doors, that He would open doors of evangelism that will be really worthwhile, and that we won't be taken for a ride like that by false promises from people that don't really know what they're talking about, and then the individual stations just don't pick it up. I was amazed, too, at what happened many years ago when they got me on Oprah. Some great national event happened, and of all things, the very time when I was on Oprah Winfrey with some of these survivalist characters that are going to dig holes in the ground and get a buffalo herd to survive up in Maine, she was preempted. All over the country, just one or two places that had Oprah, and so I got almost no coverage. Of course, it didn't cost us anything. I was just an invited guest, but that was back quite a few years ago. So I want you to think about that. Now, we're also working on the possibility of a campaign in May up in the Raleigh-Durham area. That is a very fruitful area for us. There used to be a lot of worldwide churches up there, very large attendance, and witnessed the number of people who came to Myrtle Beach when we adopted that new feast site this year. And hopefully in the month of May, I've contacted Mr. George Trent and Mr. Robert Nunnery will probably be working on it, and they'll try to find the proper venue. And I've talked about near a freeway and a high ceiling and good acoustics and good lighting and ease of parking and on and on. And when they get back to me about having found a place, we'll settle on a date, whatever is open, we'll book something there. Then what I would like to do is to get the people involved. Now, here's what we used to do in an America Listen campaign. We would rent billboards. We rented taxi boards on the back of taxis in cities like St. Louis or New York or Nashville. We rented bus stop banners. On the bus stop bench, there would be a banner there that would advertise. We rented bus placards on the side of a bus going through a downtown area, which would be advertising it. Newspaper ads, radio ads, local television spots. And what we will do in advance of the one over there is, with about a 2-month lead time, start announcing it on the end of our own television program, and then in the week before it, go ahead and buy several thousand dollars worth of spot advertising to tell them the auditorium and where I'll be and what time, and to invite people to come out. Then the local people, if they want to get involved, might do what some of our brethren did before. I don't like telemarketing, but it is effective. I don't like it. A lot of people don't like it, but it is effective. If we gave them about a 10-second thing to say, did you know that Garner Ted Armstrong is going to be speaking at the such and such a hall at such and such a time? You didn't? Well, you're invited free, so on, if they don't hang up. They probably hang up at this time. What? Him? Anyway. But, you know, all they can do is hang up. And what they might do is divide it up alphabetically or say, I'll take every third and you take every fourth name and go right through the telephone book. It's going to cost a little bit of money, local calls, but very little. And the church could help people out if they need help with the phone bill. But it's just a thought. You know, people have continually wanted to do something. They've wanted to be involved in the work and have something that they themselves are able to do and to see it bear fruit. And I preach sermons, haven't I? You remember that I preached how to double the size of the church in 1 year. If every one of the members would bring one person by their own influence and their own charming personality and good looks, and would bring one person into the church services in the course of 1 year, we would double the congregation in 1 year. But then after that sermon, we have coffee and cookies, and we mill around, shake hands, and go home and promptly forget about it. And nobody does anything about it. I know that oftentimes we're maybe a little ashamed, are we, of doctrine? Are we ashamed of the Sabbath? Are we ashamed of where we... I know we don't have a sign out there yet. I want to get one. I'd like you to pray about that, because I'd like to have the money to be able to put up a nice stone entry with a placard that says Intercontinental Church of God and Garner Ted Armstrong Evangelist Association on the other portal, perhaps. We'd like to be able to do that. Not a great big glaring sign, maybe something subdued and dignified. And I'm not going to put neon on it and say special healing night, double portion night on Thursday. like it does out there at the property they stole from us. But the property out there, it says, I think it says a special healing night on Thursday at such and such a time. So take all your cripples over there on Thursday. Also, something to pray about. You realize, I'm sure, because of the sporadic method, you know, you only get 21st Century Watch very sporadically, don't you? And you only get the newspaper once in a while, don't you? We need very badly to be able to have a monthly publication. That costs a lot of money. I don't know what Mr. Brazil would tell me if I ask him right here what it would be to publish something like TCW to the entire 50,000 plus mailing list every single month, but it would be significant. Be a lot of postage, a lot of printing, a lot of envelopes, and it would be a huge bulk mailing. But we need to be doing that. We need to make a stir. We need to make a noise. We need to have a witness and a warning going out. And the only way we're going to do it is catch 22. If more people get on the mailing list and a higher percentage of those on the list begin to become donors, but they won't be until they know where we are. But we can't tell them where we are until we have the money. But we can't get the money until more people are on the mailing list. It's like the guy went looking for a job and said, I need a job in your company. He says, you can't. You're not a union member. He went to the union and said, I want to join the union. You can't, because you got to have a job to be in a union. So it's sort of catch 22. Not really, but it grows all too slowly, doesn't it? And it's been a long time getting there, but we better count our blessings. And by the way, I want to tell you what people in Broward and Dade County are doing for Thanksgiving. They are recounting their blessings. Just wanted to pass that on to you and let you know. I don't know if everybody got that. In Broward County in Florida, they're recounting their blessings. Okay. Well, we do need all of these areas in which we need to grow, and we do not want to play church, but we certainly do want to be a faithful church and a praying church. And I will tell you that if there comes a kind of an emergency or a quasi-emergency or something that is a real need, I will tell you in advance that I will not be real hesitant to ask God's people to fast on a special day for a special purpose and to pray together to accomplish a particular thing. I've seen it produce a miracle in the past, and I have every reason to believe it will do so again in the future, but that we need to do very sparingly and only when it is really important. I think you and I can answer the question, when the Son of Man come, shall he find faith on the earth?